loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump this evening will deliver his second State of the Union address. The president is expected to focus on immigration and on his demands for a border wall and his threats to declare a national emergency to build that border wall, as well as the opioid crisis, the economy, and sentencing reform. Will the American people see the so-called presidential Donald Trump of last year's State of the Union, or will we see the angry Donald Trump of Twitter? Next, the U.S. envoy to the Korean peace talks, Stephen Biegun, will meet with high-level officials in North Korea tomorrow as preparations for the second Kim-Trump summit go down to the wire. There's also anticipation that crucial new details about the summit will be announced by President Trump during tonight's State of the Union address. Then, senior Afghan officials, including former President Hamid Karzai, met with Taliban representatives in Moscow today, weeks after the insurgents met with U.S. representatives to discuss an end to the war. Again, however, no Afghan government officials were present, and President Ashraf Ghani strongly criticized the talks as undermining his government. And then President Trump announced on Twitter yesterday that he will nominate Acting Interior Secretary David Bernhardt to formally take over the job from former Secretary Ryan Zinke, who resigned 2 months ago under an ethics cloud. Bernhardt is a former oil and agriculture industry lobbyist who Congressman Raul Grijalva, the chairman of the House Interior Committee, described as, quote, everything that's wrong with this administration, unquote. And finally, today we begin a new weekly segment dealing with the ongoing militarization of space. As the U.S. continues to withdraw from international arms treaties, will the weaponization and militarization of space bring the world closer to catastrophe? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now let's turn to the State of the Union address. President Trump this evening will deliver his second State of the Union. The president is expected to focus on immigration and on his demands for a border wall and his threats to declare a national emergency to build that wall, as well as the opioid crisis, the economy, and sentencing reform. Will the American people see the so-called presidential Donald Trump of last year's State of the Union, or will we see the angry Donald Trump from Twitter? We're joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rawl.com. Welcome back, Ted.
Thanks, John.
Ted, I couldn't really find much in the mainstream media about tonight's speech, about the content of tonight's speech, that went any deeper than this silly wall. So I went to the White House's website, and boy, they had the most interesting thing. They had the list of guests that the president is inviting and the reason why they're being invited. And it's a really interesting group of people that leads me to want to believe that the president is going to be presidential in this speech.
Do you mean he's going to hit Syria with cruise missiles tonight?
But we know Donald Trump, and it's very difficult for Donald Trump to be presidential. How do you think this is going to work out tonight?
I think he's going to thread the needle between Twitter Trump and Prez Trump, who we saw last year. This president, we usually speak about his flaws. One of his many advantages as a politician is his instincts for entertainment and for what the people want in terms of circuses, if not necessarily bread. And he's going to, I think, he understands, like I think most of us do, that the State of the Union is usually a massive letdown. It's promoted very heavily. It's going to be super exciting. Watch, 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 watch. It'll be like Super Bowls of yore. And then it turns out to be, you know, deadly dull, and nothing much happens, and there's not very many moments, and the Republicans all stand a lot, and the Democrats stay seated, and the next day nobody talks about it. That's not going to happen tonight, I think. I think he wants to interject some drama into this. And the reason I think that is because I think half the reason that he wanted this three-month government reopening was just to be able to give this speech. I mean, yes, there was the problem with the air traffic controllers at the northeastern airports that was put a lot of pressure on him to end the temporary, the partial government shutdown. But now he really wanted to give this speech, and he wanted to give it not somewhere else. He wanted to give it to a joint session of Congress. He's going to interject some drama. I think there's a strong chance he'll announce the state of emergency for the wall.
Brian, there's one interesting thing, lest we think that this is a slam dunk for a presidential-style State of the Union. The president invited a 9-year-old boy to sit in the gallery. His name is Trump. And he's being bullied because his name is Trump. And so to show his thanks for this little boy fighting the good fight in his elementary school, he's allowed to sit in the gallery. Now, with that said, I think Ted's right. I think the president is also going to pat himself on the back over this First Step Act, this sentencing reform bill that was signed into law a few weeks back, because he has several very long time prisoners who were recently released because the president signed this bill. But I think Ted's right that the focus is going to be the wall. It's going to be immigration. It's going to be a threat to declare a state of emergency, despite the fact that every Republican leader on Capitol Hill has said yesterday and today that that would be a terrible, terrible mistake. I think that we're going to see the Donald Trump that we all know.
Yeah, Donald Trump is both assuming the persona of the ultimate aggressor, you know, willing to do anything, and at the same time, the ultimate victim. So, of course, having the boy named Trump who's being bullied is a perfect prop. But that's what presidents do at every yes. State of the Union message. They invite people who are simply props. Remember, Trump had that person, I think it was in the first one, the woman whose husband was a commando at the in Yemen or something mm-hmm. like that, and he was killed.
He's got another one tonight. He's got the father of a young man who was killed on the USS Cole.
Yeah, and Trump, I think it was at the State of the Union. Maybe it was a campaign rally, but Trump came out, and because he honored this guy who would what a fallen warrior, there was sustained applause, and Trump then looked up and said, he's looking down on us right now, and he's very happy because this is the longest sustained applause ever in a State of the Union address. And like, Ted Rawl, you can't make that stuff up. Like, yeah, this dead guy is like really happy because Donald Trump extended the applause line for two more minutes.
Yeah, he'd probably be happier not to be dead, I would think.
That occurred to me. And then, of course, all the people in Yemen who have been, you know, slaughtered by the U.S. Saudi, I mean, they'd probably be happy, too, if they weren't dead.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, being dead messes up your whole week, your month, everything. Yeah, no, he's amazing. The narcissism, there is no limit to this president's narcissism. I mean, they all have to be. But he's amazing because he lets it show in a way that, you know, there's faux humility. You know, there's lower biting lip Bill Clinton. There's, you know, fake tears Barack Obama. But with this guy, he doesn't pretend. But I don't think that's a bug. I think it's a feature. I think a lot of his supporters like that about him. For them, this really is, you know, a WWE type event. And, you know, they're not really wrong. Right. They see that politics is mostly window dressing, at least electoral politics in the U.S. is not about addressing the concerns and real issues in people's lives. But it's about this stuff that's incredibly disconnected from people's lives. It's a distraction from real politics, really.
The superficiality of American politics, I would say, among the elites is ever present. I'm just looking at The Washington Post. The stories are because the Washington Post is against Trump, again, except for when he's sending cruise missiles to Syria or trying to overthrow a sovereign government like the one in Venezuela. Short of that, and besides that, they're opposed to Trump. And all of the articles about how key allies fear Trump may threaten the state of Europe's union and things like that, which are complete nonsense. But there is an element, I think, of what Trump will do tonight, Ted Rawl. I'll get your opinion and also John Kiriakou's. The government shutdown was a bad one for Trump, at least with some parts of the population. And, of course, a lot of working people suffered as a consequence. There's a line that's coming out, which is that the problem with the shutdown wasn't Trump's, but the inability of both sides in Washington to act like adults, that it was sort of a sandbox sort of rumble. And so Trump will get on and appear to be the guy reaching across the aisle, and sort of the tone of it will be, can't we all work together? Aren't we all ready to work together? And of course, the Democrats, because they actually stand for nothing, will begin to echo the same theme, even though if you look at what Trump has done on taxes or the attacks on people's health care, the vast expansion of the military budget, the war against immigrants, the war against women's rights. There's a lot to work with if you want to actually be in opposition. But again, that I believe that's where Trump is going tonight.
He has no reason not to. After all, he has the dais. He has the podium. He's up. He's in charge. Nobody's really going to pay much attention to the Democratic response. And the Democratic response is not going to be about the MEC resistance in any kind of meaningful way. As you say, there is currently no indication of exactly what the Democratic Party would do if they were given dictatorial powers over all three branches of government with the snap of a finger. So, I mean, we just don't know what they would do. There's no alternative agenda being promulgated at this point, except by the 2020 announced Democratic primary presidential contenders. And even there is just starting. So he's going, Trump needs to, he should go up there if he's just, and pretend to be open to compromise. But the truth is, of course, I don't think anything substantially is going to change in terms of the current relationship.
Yeah, I think Ted's right. We're not going to see anything substantive. I don't think the Democrats will allow anything substantive. I think the president is still stung that he was manhandled by Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. There was a comment that Peggy Noonan made in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday about Nancy Pelosi that I think hit it on the head. Nancy Pelosi is what happens when you have a Prada purse with a gun in it that turns into a person. And Nancy Pelosi really did manhandle him. It hurts. He's going to try to...
What do you mean, though?
That she was tough. She was, you know, small, thin, meek lady on the outside, and inside she was as tough as a bear, and he didn't expect it.
Because time is short, I want to ask Ted, just what about the timing? There's this announcement, federal prosecutors issue sweeping subpoena for documents from Trump inaugural committee, a sign of deepening criminal probe. This came out today from New York, the Southern District prosecutors, of course. Every inaugural committee functions as a slush fund. Doesn't matter who it is. It's just private corporations ponying up, in the case of Trump, $100 million in donations to help fund the presidential inauguration. But here's the timing of it. What do you think?
I mean, obviously, the timing of the announcement is unfortunate for Trump. You never want negative news on the same day as the State of the Union. But I don't think it's going to get to him. I mean, after all, there was the whole, grabbing comment that was a video with Billy Bush that was released right before the night before a crucial debate against Hillary Clinton. And he rocked it. You know, I mean, I think this president loves this sense of feeling besieged and beleaguered. He likes a fight. I think he would actually be worse if he didn't feel like he was up against it all the time. So I don't think it's going to get to him, but it doesn't look good, of course, in general. But I guess, speculating about this announcement, again, it doesn't sound like a Russian collusion story. Again, it sounds like a money laundering and tax impropriety story.
John, because time is so short, we didn't deal with some other issues, but we will later in our show. One of which is, of course, whether Donald Trump will use the State of the Union to make a major announcement about the second summit between Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But anyway, we'll follow that story later.
Yeah, something to watch closely. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rall.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The U.S. envoy to the Korean peace talks, Stephen Biegun, will meet with high-level officials in North Korea tomorrow as preparations for the second Donald Trump-Kim Jong-un summit go down to the wire. There is also anticipation that crucial new details about the summit will be announced by President Trump tonight during his State of the Union address. We're joined from Philadelphia by Hyun Lee, a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea, and she is a writer for ZoomInKorea.org. Hyun Lee, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you. I think we've witnessed something pretty remarkable in the last week with Stephen Biegun's speech at Stanford University. I thought it showed a new stage in the U.S. posture towards negotiations. Did you see it that way?
Yeah, I totally agree. His remarks gave me lots of hope for the upcoming talks. I mean, he basically said the Korean War is over as far as he is concerned, as far as the U.S. is concerned, and that these talks are of course, about denuclearization, but it's bigger than that. That it's about establishing new relations between the U.S. and North Korea. And, you know, this is exactly what we've been talking about for the past year, right? That these talks, that the outcome of these talks needs to lead to lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula, normalization of relations. And I think finally, I hope finally, the talks are on the right track.
Hyun Lee is our guest. Hyun, up until now or earlier, the main dominant voice that one heard here in the mainstream media and from U.S. governments is that the North Koreans had to engage in what's called complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization, also known as CVID, a new acronym, before negotiations about other issues like a peace treaty or sanctions could be discussed. It seems now that the Trump administration has abandoned that negotiating posture. And that negotiating posture actually made no sense. You could only have that negotiating posture if you didn't want to negotiate a settlement, because why would North Korea or any entity disarm itself before the war was ended? In other words, the Korean War began on June 25th, 1950. Here we are, 69 years later this June. No end to the Korean War yet. The U.S. has said, you must get rid of your nuclear weapons, then we'll talk about ending the war. Nobody would do that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we have to look at the historical context in terms of which party posed the greatest nuclear threat to the Korean Peninsula historically, right? So it was the United States that introduced nuclear weapons, 900 tactical nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula from the 1950s until the early 1990s. And really, for North Korea has always consistently maintained that the reason for its nuclear weapons program was to create a deterrence against the threat of attacks by the United States. And it is understandable because we just have to look at the long track record of the U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises, where they actually fly B-2 bombers and simulate nuclear attack on North Korea. If that is the case, then unless you guarantee peace and security for North Korea, how are you going to create an incentive for North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons? I mean, some people have said, well, the sanctions are the way to pressure North Korea to capitulate and give up its nuclear weapons. But we know that decades of that policy has not worked. And in fact, isolating North Korea has had the opposite effect, where North Korea actually sped up its nuclear weapons program. So I think you're right, absolutely right, that the way to now shift this conversation is to really look at fundamentally what is at the root of this. And we really need to go back to what was promised at the end of the Korean War back in 1953, when they signed the armistice. And in the text of the armistice, they said within 3 months of signing this armistice, we need a conference to discuss a permanent settlement of this war, the withdrawal of all foreign troops, and a permanent peace agreement. Almost 70 years have passed. That conference has not taken place. Last year, at the historic summit between the two Koreas at Panmunjom, the two leaders agreed we will pursue three or four party conference to declare an end to the Korean War, replace the armistice with a peace agreement. So they're talking about what should have been done in 1953. We now are committed to making this happen, finally. So I hope that that is an outcome that we will see out of this upcoming summit.
That's the voice of Hyun Lee. Hyun is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. She is also a writer for Zoom in Korea. Go to their website, zoominkorea.org, if you actually want to learn something about what's going on in the Korean Peninsula. Because if you're getting your news from the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, guess what? You're not going to really understand the dynamics, but you can by going to their website, zoominkorea.org. One other part of the story that's been badly misrepresented in the corporate media is this line that there was no purpose in the past of negotiating with the North Koreans because it never came to anything, right? That's said over and over again. Mm-hmm. And
for decades.
And it's said over and over again so many times that everybody starts to believe it. In 1994, Hyun, there was the General Framework Agreement signed between the United States and the North Koreans, then under the leadership of Kim Il-sung, whereby the DPRK agreed in exchange for what appeared to be a peace process to scrap its enhanced plutonium production plans. If they had not done that, they could have perhaps had as many as 75 nuclear weapons by the year 2000. They scrapped it thinking that the United States would live up to its side of the bargain. But instead, George W. Bush came in and trashed that agreement, basically, and trashed the process. And then the DPRK left the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and started building nuclear weapons, predictably. What do you think in terms of the DPRK's calculations now? Donald Trump seems to be the one to want this agreement for whatever reason, but Donald Trump might not be president in 2020. Trump reneged on the Iran nuclear arms deal. Could a Democrat or another Republican come in and do the same with the DPRK? How do you think the DPRK thinks about that issue?
Well, I can't speak for the DPRK, but I think you're right. There is always, given the history of U.S. sort of negotiating posture with other countries, there is always the risk that after this administration, another administration comes in and reneges on agreements that are made with the DPRK. So I think, you know, what needs to be done through these peace talks is not only... what is agreed to, you know, in informal agreements, but also what needs to happen is a process of normalization by which the political leadership in Washington and the public in the United States starts to shift their thinking around the relationship between the U.S. and North Korea. That 70 years of this Cold War frame has not benefited any party, and that it is actually much more beneficial for all parties to move towards peace and normal relations. One thing that, you know, I only recently learned is that, you know, if there is a military confrontation or escalation on the Korean Peninsula, that could actually lead to a situation where the U.S. and China are legally bound to be involved and potentially face off in direct armed confrontation. So, on the one hand, there is an agreement between the United States and South Korea, the Mutual Defense Treaty, that is still in force today, that commits the U.S. to defend South Korea if there is an armed attack by a foreign power on South Korea. On the other hand, there is an agreement between China and North Korea called the Treaty of Friendship that was signed in 1961, still in force today, that commits China to assist North Korea in the event of an armed attack. So that means even a small accidental war on the Korean Peninsula that spirals out of control could involve both the United States and China in direct military confrontation on the Korean Peninsula. That is obviously not something that is in the interest of any party, certainly not North and South Korea, that would devastate the peninsula, but also not China and the United States, especially at a time when the tension between the two countries is actually potentially very dangerous.
Hyun Lee, we have about 40 seconds left. In terms of your view, what's the mood in South Korea? Obviously, Moon Jae-in, I'm talking about amongst the people, Moon Jae-in has played a leadership role in this process. Does he have support at home?
Yes, of course. I mean, just look at Moon Jae-in's approval rating after the Panmunjom summit last year. It exceeded 70%. Still, the overwhelming majority of South Koreans and Koreans in the diaspora around the world applaud the inter-Korean peace process right now. As you know, the North and South, the two Koreas, actually have moved, have made dramatic progress, especially in the military domain. After they signed the agreement in September 2018, they agreed to cease all hostile acts against each other in land, air, and sea, cease military exercises aimed at each other along the division line. They established a no-fly zone. I mean, these are dramatic steps that the two Koreas are taking. And the majority of South Koreans approve of this. They think the two Koreas actually need to move even further towards arms reduction. But the key piece that we will need in order for the two Koreas to, to move even further is a peace agreement among the original parties of the Korean War so that all parties can move towards arms reduction.
That's the voice of Hyun Lee. She is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. She is a writer for Zoom in Korea. You can read her works and the works of others there at zoominkorea.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Senior Afghan officials, including former President Hamid Karzai, met with Taliban representatives in Moscow today, weeks after the insurgents met with U.S. representatives to discuss an end to the war. Again, however, no Afghan government officials were present, and President Ashraf Ghani strongly criticized the talks as undermining his government. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar-in-residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. Welcome back, Dr. Weinbaum.
Hello there.
Thanks for joining us. I have to ask you, it seems like there are parallel talks now where you have the Taliban negotiating with the United States, you have the Taliban negotiating with prominent Afghan personalities like Hamid Karzai, but there are no direct contacts yet between the Taliban and the Afghan government. Why is that? And because there are no direct contacts yet, does it doom these other two paths?
Yes, I think it does. I think that unless and until they're willing to talk directly with the Afghan government, it's going to be very difficult for the United States, as much as it is angling to get it out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. But if it does so without a ceasefire and some kind of discussions between the Taliban and the government in Kabul, it's going to look too much like we've sold them out. And again, as much as we want to get out, it will be very hard to do so. Now, as far as the Moscow discussions, they're significant because it's part of the Taliban's approach here that we're not against talking to Afghans. Indeed, we think this has to be settled in intra-Afghan discussions, negotiation. But we don't want to talk to the Kabul government because they're not really in a position to negotiate. They're just puppets, the line goes, for the United States. Now, what's interesting about the meeting in Moscow is that opposition politicians in the country, prominent people representing some of the, or really all of the major opposition parties, are in Moscow today talking. And they're there not with the expectation that somehow they're going to be some kind of breakthrough that they're able to accomplish, but they're all trying to diminish the Kabul government in the lead up to the elections, which will take place this summer. So what they want to show is that this government has no credibility and that there should be an interim government and then elections, which they hope to oust the Ashraf Ghani government.
So this isn't a situation where these Afghan oppositionists are purporting to speak for the Afghan government or are attempting to negotiate on behalf of the Afghan government. This is really a two-sided effort to perhaps embarrass or even weaken Ashraf Ghani.
That's right. Remember that the government was specifically denied presence in Moscow. Now, it did. There was an earlier Moscow meeting, which they did attend, but at that point, it was the Taliban who, although invited, refused to come. This is really a great deal to do with domestic politics. And no, they're not speaking for the government. They don't claim to. And in fact, they would probably make the case that eventually you're going to have to speak with the government. But right now, they're taking advantage of the opportunity to show that maybe they can make greater progress. Now, at the same time, this casts the American negotiations, or sidelines it, I should say. It means that there's an alternative to the American approach, and I think that Russia would like to say that whatever goes on in Afghanistan, we want very much to be part of it. So this is a bit of a struggle between the United States and Russia as well, because we're in a position where both parties are trying to say they can do what has to be done in terms of ending the conflict, but theirs is the way to do it.
So should we expect to see anything substantive come out of the Moscow talks like we would like to see coming out of the Doha talks between the United States and...
We'll get the same thing. They're going to come out and they're going to say, we made progress. I think that that can bet on that. Whatever happens, there won't be, I don't believe, any kind of confrontation. All parties will want to make this look like it was a worthwhile venture because they're really going out on a limb, particularly the fact that former President Hamid Karzai is leading that delegation. Now, that's a big step when your predecessor, in effect, has turned his back on you in this fashion, on the government. But I, again, in answer to your question, I don't think they're going to portray this as somehow that they're exclusively the people to talk with, but only that they are, discussions with them will further the whole process.
Dr. Marvin Weinbaum is our guest. He is a scholar in residence and director of the Middle East Institute Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. Dr. Weinbaum, let's just talk about what's really in the mind and the heart, say, of the Trump administration regarding Afghanistan. Trump said that he would reduce the number of U.S. troops by half. He had said in the past that the U.S. should leave Afghanistan. There seemed to be pushback from some within the Pentagon, especially in the uniformed services high command. Do you think that there's a debate going on inside the Trump administration about what to do?
Well, I think there's a debate going on within the country as to what to do. One has only to reference, for example, the New York Times editorial yesterday, which was a full-page editorial, which was suggesting that the United States ought to leave sometime this year, with or without an agreement, leave in a responsible, orderly way, but that it was time to call it quits. So when you have a paper with the prestige of the New York Times expressing this frustration, this is quite significant. Now, I disagree with it because I think that it fails to recognize how it simply leaves the Afghan people in the lurch here. To leave without having stabilized the situation through a ceasefire, some kind of agreement on which you can base a departure. If the United States reduces down to where it's a meaningless number of troops or completely leaves, as the Times and others are saying, that it's time just simply to walk away, if we do this, we're going to be leaving them exposed. And everybody, it seems, is making a reference here to Vietnam and what happened in Vietnam. But I think the appropriate reference here, the cautionary lesson that has to be learned, what happened in 1989 and 1990. The Soviet Army left in 1989, and in 1990, although it was signaled even earlier, the United States simply walked away from the region. It said, let the Afghans fend for themselves, and we don't really have a great deal of strategic interest in the region. It was harder to make that case today with international terrorism and nuclear weapons in the subcontinent. But nevertheless, we'd be doing pretty much the same thing. And as the New York Times suggests, and I think foolishly, somehow the neighbors here will be able to assure that terrorists do not take over the country and that they'll be able to help stabilize the country, the Afghanistan. Now, I don't know why they would think so. That didn't happen in 1990. What did happen in 1990 is when the United States completely disengaged from the region, what occurred then, beginning in 1992, was a bloody civil war. In fact, a war that most Afghans would say is the worst that they've ever experienced, where different elements of the Mujahideen, which had been the victorious party, were shelling one another, and the country was just in anarchy. Well, in that milieu, in that environment, what you got was the emergence of Al-Qaeda and, of course, of the Taliban. So the legacy of the 1990s, I think is the one to keep in mind here, that it's not in any of the neighbors' interests, Iran, Russia, China, Pakistan. It's not in any of their interests to have chaos in Afghanistan. And I think an irresponsible departure, although it can't go on forever that the United States is there, but an irresponsible one is really not what they want or need either. They don't want to see the reemergence of a Taliban that is dependent for its survival on radical militant forces in the region. And that is likely to be the outcome. So what I'm saying here really is that the feel-good position here is let's just wipe our hands of it. And I can understand why after all these years we would say that. But my own view is that a minimal investment, if it can keep even the stalemate going, is better than the consequences.
That was the voice of Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar-in-residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. He joined us from Washington. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump announced on Twitter yesterday that he will nominate Acting Interior Secretary David Bernhardt to formally take over the job from former Secretary Ryan Zinke, who resigned 2 months ago under an ethics cloud. Bernhardt is a former oil and agriculture industry lobbyist who Congressman Raul Grijalva, the chairman of the House Interior Committee, described as, quote, everything that's wrong with this administration, unquote. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He's professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation from Monthly Review Press. Welcome back, Fred.
Good to be with you.
Fred, this former lobbyist for the oil industry and the agriculture industry is going to, if he is finally confirmed, is going to be in charge of the Fish and Wildlife Commission. He's going to be in charge of public parks. He's going to be in charge of Indian Affairs. I think Grijalva is right that this is exactly the wrong signal to send to the American people. If you're trying to drain the swamp, you don't invite the swamp monsters in to take over the leadership.
Well, the swamp has definitely not been drained. It's deeper and it's got some different animals in it, but they're more vicious than the old animals that used to be in the swamp.
A scarier swamp.
Basically, you know, it's in keeping with what the administration has done in other, departments. In fact, I mean, this guy has apparently, Bernhardt, that is, has apparently been more or less running the department. Zinke really wasn't that interested in the day-to-day stuff, apparently.
That's exactly correct. He wasn't interested in the day-to-day stuff. And this guy has been running the department for a very long time. In addition to that, I'm looking at a piece in NPR that ran this morning. Bernhardt was in the Interior Department for 8 years during the George W. Bush administration. He was the Solicitor General of the Department of the Interior, in which he essentially opened public lands to developers, especially to oil and mineral developers. And then when Obama became president, he went back into lobbying and representing the oil industry and the mining industry and the agriculture industry. He's from the West. He's from a place called Rifle, Colorado. And it says here that environmental protection groups are assailing the nomination, while industry groups say that they love the nomination.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think he sees his constituency as being the oil and gas and the mineral other mineral corporations that he's there to do their bidding. Basically, in any other administration, you would say this would be shocking. In this administration, it's more or less in keeping with everything else they've done, which is all shocking. You know, it's not any more than what they've done to EPA, you know, or others. It's a bad nomination. And according to the Washington Post, he's got a list of 26 companies that he's got potential conflicts of interest with. And he keeps that on a card. And he consults the card you know, because he wants to not overstep the bounds of, you know, the conflict of interest policy. But the reality is, of course, what he's doing is a major conflict of interest with the rights and the desires of the American people.
Fred Magdoff is our guest. I'm looking at CNBC. The headline is, Trump's war on energy and environmental regulation is about to face the, quote, Spanish Inquisition, close quote. Now, the article talks about the fact that the House has regained, the Democrats have regained control of the House. I guess that's the feared Spanish Inquisition that Trump is coming against. President Donald Trump set into motion a vast rollback of energy, climate, and environmental regulations during his first 2 years in office. Over the next 2 years, those actions will face intense scrutiny on Capitol Hill. On Thursday, Democrats will take control of the House. This was written a month ago. Of the House of Representatives and the committees that conduct government oversight. Within the next few months, incoming committee chairs intend to hold a series of hearings to pick apart Trump's energy and environmental policies and what role industry insiders play in crafting them. You know what, Fred Magdoff? I just don't feel Trump is up against the Spanish Inquisition when he's facing this incoming Democratic majority in the House.
No, I wouldn't think it qualifies as the Inquisition. But, I mean, they have the opportunity to have hearings and to subpoena officials and to get records. So, I mean, Congress does have a significant power in this respect of oversight. But the problem is, even if it comes out, the Trump folks are going to say, so what? You know, I mean, even if the most egregious types of activities come out, In any other administration, it would have created a big hullabaloo. It's not clear if it would in this. But still, it's important to get the information out, to find out what's really happening, the details of what's happening in these various agencies, including the Interior Department.
I just want to remind everybody, John, before you go forward, yeah, that the Spanish Inquisition actually used torture to get confessions from those brought before the Inquisition. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Let's talk about what we should expect from this guy. It says here that the Department of the Interior manages one-fifth of all the land in the United States. That's a lot of land. That includes the wealth of oil, natural gas, and coal below the ground. Under the Trump administration, oil and gas leases on public lands managed by the department last year generated $960 million. That's a 90% increase over the year before. And it's because the Trump Interior Ministry has opened up all these new federal lands to mining. Now, since Bernhardt became the acting secretary 2 months ago, he has ordered the deletion of an entire chapter from the department's handbook, the chapter being on climate change, as you can imagine, because there is no such thing, apparently, as climate change.
It was very cold last week, and as the president pointed out,
proof. That's the proof right there.
Come back, global warming, we need you.
Yes, uh-huh. He also has ordered a rolling back of protections under the Endangered Species Act, and he ordered the relaxation of methane rules for oil and gas companies. This is all in the last 2 months. Now imagine if he's confirmed by the Senate, what the next 2 years are going
to
look like.
They're sprinting, Fred. This is not a long-distance run. These guys are sprinting to basically destroy every regulation that would somehow halt or slow down both pollution and global warming.
Yeah, I mean, you put this together with what the EPA is doing, and it's quite a combination. Absolutely. No, this is it's not like the United States was doing wonderful things in this respect, that is, in trying to combat global warming. But at least there was some, you know, minimal activities happening and some restrictions. You know, one of the issues also on the you know, the oil and gas and the other types of leases, which, and by the way, includes, you know, leasing for agricultural purposes, mainly range and rangeland, is that usually the U.S. government gets a very raw deal on this. In other words, it's really great for the companies, but this is giving away, essentially, resources owned by the American people at very, very low prices. You know, I mean, they're selling it technically, but at very low prices, the royalties that go to the government. that itself is a scandal. First off, they shouldn't be doing it. And then the second thing is that if they're going to do it, they should at least get some real money for it.
Yeah, Fred Magdoff, 1 minute left. 50 years ago, our water was dirtier, less drinkable. Our air was more polluted. Regulations have made a difference, not what they needed to do, but significant advances. How long lasting, let's say Donald Trump isn't reelected, how long lasting will these new sort of deregulation efforts, how long lasting will they be?
Well, if you get in an administration and a Congress that's interested in backing that administration that really wants to reverse this, you know, it can be a blip. It's certainly a possibility. I mean, I think the leases will, once they've been agreed to, I don't think there's any way to cancel them. I don't know the legality of that. But still, that's relatively, you know, what they do in a few years if you undo the regulation part and you stop with the leasing of public lands for these purposes. And, you know, part of doing away with or lessening the area of a couple of national parks was to be able to take that land and then, you know, basically, you know, allow free range for the corporations to exploit it. So I think damage will be done, no question. I mean, it's being done right now. But I think that if there really is a reversal in 2 years, it does not have to be much more than a blip.
Yeah, I'm not confident, John. I know we're out of time. I'm not confident that even if the Democrats come in, that they will actually undo some of this, because the same corporations are backing them.
It's true. It all comes down to the money. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He is a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and also Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. That is from Monthly Review Press. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we begin a new weekly segment dealing with the ongoing militarization of space. As the U.S. continues to withdraw from international arms treaties, will the weaponization and militarization of space bring the world closer to catastrophe? We're joined from Old Westbury, New York by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. And he's also the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. Welcome, Professor Grossman.
A pleasure.
So since this is our first episode of this segment, let's talk about the weaponization, the militarization of space through history. You know, we all look at Ronald Reagan and his Star Wars policy back in the 1980s, but really the militarization of space goes back to the formation of NASA, I think. Would you agree?
It actually goes back before that in a terribly scary way. There was something called Project Paperclip. This was put together by the United States after World War II. And what we did was bring Nazi scientists to the United States, including Wernher von Braun and many. Well, he was a space scientist, as many of these Nazi scientists were. And they worked with the U.S. military back in the 45, 46, 47, developing space military capacity. For example, the Redstone rocket, which was the first U.S. rocket capable of carrying a nuclear weapon, that was a duplicate of the Nazi V-2 rocket. And it was put together by a team of, again, former Nazi scientists working out of the Redstone Army Arsenal down in Alabama. And this effort, this push, continued for years with all kind of plans to, one scheme was to have, no satellite had been launched yet, but these Nazi scientists envisioned having satellites up in space, battle platforms, which would be able to, with weaponry on board, dominate the Earth below. Again, they pushed and pushed. And then with Ronald Reagan, we had a full-blown Star Wars plan with that base. You mentioned NASA. NASA was created a year after the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. And it was supposed to be a civilian agency. But my work through the years, and I've written books and done TV shows and so forth on this, is at NASA it realized where the money was and is in the United States, the Pentagon in terms of government money. So it became a partner with the U.S. military and space activity.
How long was it before Americans had a problem with the idea of militarizing space? How long was it before peace groups finally got organized?
Well, I think it took the Star Wars plan of Reagan to really motivate the public. I mean, it was very clear what the Nazi scientists were doing was sort of like under the table, and there was not good journalism on it. People didn't know much about it. If folks want to know about that phase of U.S. space military activity, I'd suggest they get a book called Arming the Heavens by Jack Mano, M-A-N-N-O. He's still around. He's a retired professor, like I am. I'm not retired, however. Also, he was a professor at SUNY at the Environmental Science and Forestry College. And Arming the Heavens just spells it out. It names the names and names the projects and outlines the program.
And then you got involved in the peace movement as well. Tell us a little bit about the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space.
Yeah, well, very importantly, this is 1992. The Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space was organized. It was in a meeting I attended, and I fully participated in the creation of the Global Network, a meeting in Washington, D.C., and it's the leading group in the world, in fact, in challenging the weaponization of space. A wonderful organizer, a seasoned organizer, his mentor was Cesar Chavez, is the coordinator of the Global Network. In fact, they have an annual conference, an international conference, every year, and this year it's going to be in Russia. I've attended many of the conferences. They've been all over the world, and the Global Network is truly a global organization with people from countries all over the planet, and it's something very positive that people could do. I mean, you hear these stories, and these are horror stories, turning the heavens into a war zone, as the U.S. is now very much under Trump pushing to do. But the group that's been challenging that all along, when Reagan, in the wake of Reagan's presidency, when Bush became president, then George W. Bush, and you know all these various U.S. administrations seeking to weaponize space, there has been the Global Network. And you can check out their website. It's Space for Peace, Space for, and it's the numeral for, peace.org. Check out the website, and I'd urge listeners to wherever you're listening from, join up with the Global Network.
We're talking with Professor Carl Grossman. Professor Grossman is a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's the author of numerous books, and he's the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. We're talking to Professor Grossman today, and we will be talking to him every Tuesday in this segment on the ongoing militarization of space and its impact on everything. Carl Grossman, in military strategy or in the art of military warfare, having the high ground is always considered to be tactically and strategically crucial. Is outer space the new high ground?
Yeah, in fact, U.S. military documents, and in my work and in my TV shows on this, I actually present some of the military documents describing space as the ultimate high ground. And from space, the U.S. would have control over the Earth below. Again, we go way back, decades and decades back. This was the vision of those Nazi scientists. Today now, I mean, literally today, Space News is reporting. They have a special, well, it's called Military Space. It's part of Space News. And it's reporting that the Space Force that Trump announced last year that he was going to push to create, which would have America dominate space. He's having a little trouble with the Space Force now with the Democrats in control of the House. But Space News reports today about the creation by the president of a U.S. Space Command. And this U.S. Space Command would lay the groundwork according to Space News. I mean, folks could get this piece online, this article online today. Just Google Space Command, Space Force, Space News. Again, Trump has ordered this now, creation of a U.S. Space Command. And from there, according to the article, he hopes somehow he can go ahead with a space force. But whether you call it a space command or a space force, what this article describes in terms of the space command's function is that it will be a combatant entity of the U.S. military, which is just flies in the space, in the flat face of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which was created by the United States, England, and the Soviet Union, the then Soviet Union, to keep space for peace. And it's held for decades. Of course, now, as you mentioned in opening the show, with the United States breaking treaties, just now the INF Treaty, we have to worry about the Outer Space Treaty and whether it'll last, whether the United States will try to eliminate that treaty too and eliminate space being, as under the treaty, it's described as a global commons, a place for peaceful purposes.
It's really something. And Professor Grossman, we have 30 seconds left. Militarizing outer space, preparing for war in outer space, means to prepare for robotic warfare. It means to prepare for automatic or machine-led warfare, because how do you actually fight in outer space except on that basis? It would seem to me that the likelihood of a profound accident even is so great that everyone should stop and think and say, wait, this is not a good idea. 30 seconds left.
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to trust the future for our children, for their children, to computers running these laser weapons and hypervelocity guns and particle beams, these kind of weapons that the United States has wanted to put up in space. And now under Trump, the push is on.
We will leave it there. We were joined from Old Westbury, New York, by Professor Carl Grossman. He's a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He's also the author of 6 books and the host of a nationally aired television program focused on environmental, energy, and space issues. He'll be joining us every week to talk about the militarization of space. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.